For my first show back, I chose to do a bit I had developed years earlier at the Ice House. I speed-talked a Vegas nightclub act in 2 minutes. Appearing on the show was Sammy Davis Jr., who, while still performing energetically, had also become a historic showbiz figure. I was whizzing along, singing a 4-second version of Ebb Tide, then saying at lightning speed, "Frank Sinatra, personal friend of mine, Sammy Davis Jr., personal friend of mine, Steve Martin, I'm a personal friend of mine too, and now a little dancing." I started a wild flail, which I must say was pretty funny, when a showbiz miracle occurred. The camera cut away to a dimly lit Johnny, precisely as he whirled up from his chair, doubling over with laughter. Suddenly, subliminally, I was endorsed. At the end of the act, Sammy came over and hugged me. I felt like I hadn't been hugged since I was born. This was my 16th appearance on the show, and the first one I could really call a smash. The next day, elated by my success, I walked into an antique store on La Brea. The woman behind the counter looked at me. "Are you that boy who was on The Tonight Show last night?" "Yes," I said. "Yuck," she blurted out. Breakthrough. I did have a tiny bit of drawing power, generated through my daytime television appearances and my growing presence on The Tonight Show, but mostly my name was a rumor. My dubious status as a headliner led me to a tiny pie slice of a folk club in Greenwich Village, the Metro. Now I had an opening act. Still, no one showed up to see me in a new duo, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks. I told the club owner that he could let me go if he wanted, that I wouldn't hold him to his contract. He said he wanted me to stay, until the next night, when again no one showed up. We parted with a handshake. In March 1975, my agent Marty Klein secured a job in San Francisco, 2 weeks headlining the Playboy Club for $1,500 per week. A big payday, and I was desperate for money. Playboy clubs always made me nervous. I never seemed to do well in them, but I had no choice. Opening night was on a Monday, which was already unusual. Clubs were usually closed on Mondays. I stood at the back of the club and checked out the capacity crowd. Amazed, I said to one of the musicians leaning against the wall, "We got a nice house out there." An odd look crossed the musician's face. "Yeah," he said mysteriously. After I was introduced as Steve Miller, I walked out on stage and saw a sea of Japanese faces. I attempted a few lines. Nothing came back except nice smiles. No one spoke English. It turned out that the bus tours offered a nightclub as part of their packages, but on Mondays, the Playboy Club was the only one open, so every foreign tour group was herded into this showroom. Now I understood the musician's wry grin. I gamely went forward, not doing badly because the audience was kind and polite, and my balloon animal and magic act went over well because it was visual and antic. The next night, I went on for the regular audience. Death. Comedy death. Which is worse than regular death. I sank low, and in spite of my declining financial situation, called Marty saying, "You've got to get me out of here." He did, and I went back the next night to collect my things. My clothes had been stolen. A week later, I took out a bank loan of $5,000. The euphoria from my week at Bubba's in Coconut Grove and my nice score on The Tonight Show had dissipated, and I was marooned in the depression that followed my flop at the Playboy Club. In June 1975, I was booked into the frighteningly named Hub Pub Club in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. The Hub Pub Club, located in a shopping mall, was trying to be a fancy spot for gentlemen, but the liquor laws in North Carolina limited attendance at nightclubs to members only. About the worst thing an entertainer can hear are members only and group tours. While I was on stage doing my act to church-like silence, a guy said to his date, loud enough that we all heard it, "I don't understand any of this." And at that moment, neither did I. In spite of the gloom, I had a premonition of success. And in January 1975, I started a short-lived diary. It surprises me that a diary meant to chronicle an important year in my life could contain so many negative passages. My entry for the Hub Pub Club started this way: "This town smells like a cigarette." Then I sank a bit lower. My material seemed so old, the audience indulged me during the second show. Then I really started wallowing in it. My act might have well been in a foreign language. My act has no ending. Next, I degenerated into my version of Kurtz's Lament, "The Horror, the Horror," from Heart of Darkness. My new material is hopelessly poor. My act is simply not good enough. It's not even bad. However, there was one sole positive entry in my journal that week. It related to a lonely guy phone call I had made to a new acquaintance, Victoria Daly. Victoria was a young, rare book and print dealer in Los Angeles whom I had stumbled upon in my collecting quests, and who had her wits about her in the same way that Oscar Wilde had his wits about him. I must have had an intuition about the future depth and scope of our relationship as I called her long distance from a motel phone, which in those days cost about $1 million a minute. While traffic whizzed by outside the gray motel room, I churned out my Winston-Salem stories with the same toxicity as the R.J. Reynolds Company churned out cigarettes. Victoria used her refined sense of artistic ethics to talk me down from my metaphorical window ledge, and over the next few years we cemented an enduring relationship that has been complex and rewarding. We have been connected over the past 30 years intellectually, aesthetically, and seemingly gravitationally. In my latest conversation with her, I complimented her recent essay on early Southern California history. I said, "Do you realize you're going to be studied one day?" She replied, "Only one day?" 2 months after Winston-Salem, everything was about to change. A few blocks away from San Francisco's Playboy Club, where I had died so swiftly, was a very different kind of club, one that booked current music acts, and where the waitresses were sexy but didn't have to wear bunny outfits. I had played the boarding house before, but only as a developing opening act. The owner, David Allen, saw that things were different, both with my act and with its reception, and he was ready to try the new and improved me. In August 1975, I was booked to headline, evidence that the boarding house and the Playboy Club did not speak to each other. My years on the road had produced a change I had only dreamed of earlier. I now had 4 hours of material from which to pick and choose, and there was more to come. I opened at the boarding house on a Tuesday evening to a fair-sized crowd, headlining there, in friendly and familiar San Francisco, where I had established some kind of beachhead, filled me and the audience with confidence. They had paid to see this show, this particular show, and I was inspired to push the limits even further. What had been deadly at the Playboy clubs was lively with a younger crowd. I wanted the audience to leave with the feeling that something had happened. The first few minutes into the show, I began to strum the banjo, singing a song that had no particular tune or rhyme. "We're having some fun. No place called home. We've got music and laughter and wonderful times. And that's so important in today's world. Oh, yeah. It's so hard to laugh. It seems that short of tripping a nun, nothing is funny anymore. But you know, I see people going to college for 14 years, studying to be doctors and lawyers. And I see people going to work at the drugstore at 7:30 every morning. To sell flare pins. But the most amazing thing to me is I get paid for doing this." Midweek, before the show, I told the spotlight operator not to change the light no matter how urgently I asked him to do it. Then, on stage, I made a small request for some mood lighting, a blue spotlight. The light stayed white. I slowly grew more and more angry. "Please," I said, "I would really like a blue spot. It's for the mood lighting thing." I got very serious and murmured under my breath, "I can't even get a light change." John McEwen was sitting in the light booth that night. He said the operator began to believe me and moved to change the spot, but John stopped him. Soon it became clear that it was a gag, because I was reaching new levels of anger as I said how disgusting it was that I, this entertainer, who keeps giving and giving and giving and keeps on giving, can't seem to get a simple blue spotlight. The bit ended at an exaggerated level of madness, with me screaming another phrase from my past. "Well, excuse me," turning 4 syllables into about 20. The audience response was nice enough. But I was surprised weeks later when I heard this expression coming back to me on the streets. It surprised me even more when in another few years it became a ubiquitous catchphrase. Toward the end of the boarding house show, I stepped off the stage saying, "I just want to come down into the audience with my people. Don't touch me!" I took them into the lobby where there was an old-fashioned grand staircase. One of the doormen, a very likable and funny guy named Larry, who had seen my show all week, happened to come in from the street carrying a pair of pants on a hanger fresh from the dry cleaner. I looked at him, and he looked back, knowing he was in for it. He had a great sense of humor and didn't mind a bit. I said disdainfully, "Oh, it's clean pants. Mr. Clean Pants, you think your pants are so clean. Well, Clean Pants, we don't need your type around here. Wait, Clean Pants, where you going? You think you don't need us because your pants are so clean?" A better comic foil could not have been found. I can still see Larry standing there holding his dry cleaning and accepting the fake lambasting with bemused patience. And the audience, crowded together in the stairwell and mezzanine, ate it up. My sister Melinda had gotten married and was raising her two children in San Jose, an hour's drive from San Francisco. My communication with her over the past decade had been minimal. She had made efforts to connect, but my travel kept sweeping me away, and I was most comfortable in the world I had made, detached from home ties. When I first became an uncle, I could have used a self-help book, "So Now You're an Uncle." Melinda showed up at one of these boarding house performances, and we visited after the show. It turned out that she had been proudly monitoring my career from a distance, saving reviews and magazine stories. But our relationship, because of my familial ineptness, remained awkward and was not ready to bloom. Bill McEwen dragged his Nagra up to San Francisco and started taping my shows in hope of crafting a record from the material. John Wasserman, the critic at the San Francisco Chronicle, offered a rave of the boarding house appearance that was so enticing it made me want to see the show. At the end of the week, I was handed my percentage of the gate, an envelope containing $4,500 in cash, a sum I had never seen in one place before, much less in my needy and greedy palm. I walked home in the dark toward my room at the Hotel Commodore, still lugging my banjo, which I never let out of my sight. And fortunately, I was not mugged. There was something about that walk in the night that recalled my contemplative mood of 9 years earlier, when I sat in darkness, just a few miles away at the coffee gallery, with absolutely no prospects. But now, I was about to enter a phase of my life when three things would occur. I would earn money, I would grow to be famous, and I would be the funniest I ever was. After the boarding house gig, I was booked into a club in Nashville called the Exit Inn. It was a low-ceilinged box, painted black inside, with two noisy smoke-eaters hanging from the ceiling to no avail. The dense second-hand smoke was being inhaled and exhaled, making it third-hand and fourth-hand smoke. The stage was perfectly situated in the corner of the room. When I was performing, I could touch the ceiling with my hand, and I had to be careful when jumping on stage not to knock myself out. I was selling tickets without the usual requirement of hit records. The audience was there by word of mouth only, so everything they saw me do was new. The room seated about 250, and the shows were oversold, riotous, and packed tight, which verified a growing belief of mine about comedy. The more physically uncomfortable the audience, the bigger the laughs. I continued closing the show by performing outside, which had an auxiliary effect of emptying out the house so the second show could begin. One night at the Exit Inn, I took the crowd down the street to a McDonald's and ordered 300 hamburgers to go, then quickly changed it to one bag of fries. Another night, I took them to a club across the street, and we watched another act. I was a new enough performer that there was no overblown celebrity worship, which meant I could do the show and carouse in the streets, uninterrupted by ill-timed requests for autographs or photos. Even though I had done the act hundreds of times, it became new to me this hot, muggy week in Nashville. The disparate elements I'd begun with 10 years earlier had become unified. My road experience had made me tough as steel, and I had total command of my material. But most important, I felt really, really funny. I moved to Aspen, Colorado to be closer to my pals Bill McEwen and the Dirt Band. It was there, on the night of October 11, 1975, that I turned on the TV and watched the premiere episode of Saturday Night Live. Fuck, I thought, they did it. The new comedy had been brought to the airwaves in New York by people I didn't know, and they were incredibly good at it, too. The show was a heavy blow to my inner belief that I alone was leading the cavalry and carrying the new comedy flag. Saturday Night Live and I, however, were destined to meet. My performing role continued. Dave Felton, a highly regarded rock and roll journalist, interviewed me for an article in Rolling Stone. He did a perceptive job of quoting my act verbatim, using pauses, italics, and sudden jumps into all capital letters. It read funny, even the visual stuff, and rather than kill the act through exposure, he made it a necessity to see in person. Felton wrote, "This isn't comedy. It's campfire recreation for the bent at heart. It's a laugh-along for loonies, Disneyland on acid." On the strength of everything that was happening, Bill McEwen closed a record deal with an uneasy Warner Brothers. He took the boarding house recordings up to his studio in Aspen and began editing them. I was still adding to the show. My Ramblin' Guy persona had been inspired way back by the folk singer Ramblin' Jack Elliott's outlaw stance, then reinforced by the Allman Brothers hit Ramblin' Man, and even Joni Mitchell's He's a Rambler and a Gambler and a Sweet-Talkin' Ladies Man. It seemed like all the sexy guys were ramblers. I would sing, "I'm Ramblin'." I like to give myself heroic qualities that were obviously delusional. I started saying with mock self-importance, "I'm so wild." Then, "I'm a wild and crazy guy," which actually was a bailout if a bit didn't work. The piece developed into this. "Yes, I'm a wild and crazy guy, the kind of guy who might like to do anything at any time, to drink champagne at 3 a.m., or maybe at 4 a.m., eat a live chipmunk, or maybe even wear two socks on one foot."